Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to hear Professor Gillian Treake's talk. I'll introduce her briefly. She's well known to you here. Emeritus Professor Gillian Treake is President of the Australian Human Rights Commission, taking up her appointment by the Commonwealth Attorney General in 2012. She was Dean of the Faculty of Law and Chartist Professor of International Law at the University of Sydney from 2007 to 2012, and Director of the British Institute of International and Comparative Law from 2005 to 2007. She's a former barrister with Seven Wentworth Chambers and Governor of the College of Law. And tonight we're here at King & Wood Mellisons, and our speaker also worked in her time not only as a barrister but also with what was then Mellison Stephen Jakes in Melbourne, which is now this firm with a slightly different name. And our speaker's going to talk for us tonight on the topic of freedom of speech and racial vilification. One man's freedom ends where another's starts. Professor Triggs, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Jared, and good evening, everyone. I'm very pleased indeed to have the opportunity to contribute to this Sydney Institute Speakers Program and to discuss two freedoms, the freedom of speech and freedom from racial vilification. The Sydney Institute is an invaluable not-for-profit group that promotes freedom of expression, and I'm delighted that I've recently been accepted as a member. If I can distort the Marx Brothers quip, I'm very happy to join a club that will accept me as a member. And in this glorious environment with King & Wood Mellisons, where I'm always very happy to come back, and this wonderful view of the harbour on a lovely sunny Sydney evening, it's very appropriate that I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and to express my respect for their elders past and present. Well, in politics, context and timing are everything. This election year has been a roller coaster ride for human rights. It's a truism that with bipartisan support for human rights, great advances can be achieved, notably the legislation for constitutional recognition for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders and the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Contested political views on fundamental freedoms can, by contrast, lead to egregious breaches of human rights of asylum seekers and their children, Indigenous youths in adult prisons, even bikie gangs. Over this last year, a passionate public debate has ensued as to whether our 1995 federal racial vilification laws place a fair restriction on the right to freedom of speech in the 21st century multicultural and democratic society that is Australia. In this charged political environment, the opposition undertook that if elected, they would either repeal or amend Section 18C of the Racial Vilification Act, or Racial Discrimination Act, I should say. Section 18C makes it a civil wrong to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate a person in public on the grounds of their race, colour, national origin, or ethnicity. The former opposition saw Section 18C as an unreasonable restriction on the right to freedom of speech, arguing that robust, even hurtful, racial abuse in public is part of the cut and thrust of Australian life and democracy. Well, what prompted these calls for reform? This year, we've seen racial abuse on public transport, filmed on iPhones and immediately sent viral. We've witnessed racial abuse on the football field, and we've heard it repeated on the radio. Ironically, Australia granted a visa to Mr. Geert Wilders to speak on Islam, despite the offence he causes to many, while Senator Xenophon was ignominiously ejected from Malaysia, apparently because he supports free elections in that country. Debate about the civil liability of Andrew Bolt for his remarks about fair-skinned Aboriginal people 2 years ago was revisited in the debate about the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill, the ill-fated Consolidation Bill, introduced by the former government to extend protections against offending and insulting behaviour to additional grounds including religion, industrial history and pregnancy. Adding to the conflation of legal issues that all of this created, and following the Finkelstein report calling for tighter control of the media, the former government attempted but failed to create the Office of Public Interest Media Advocate. And more recently, legal action has just been brought against a Sydney academic who supported a wide-ranging boycott against Israel. These are testing times for freedom of speech. And our now attorney has categorised this year, I believe, at the Sydney Institute, as a multi-front war against the traditional liberal conception of freedom of speech. Well, since the election, the attorney has repeated his intent to reform the racial offence provision with the support of the Prime Minister, and he's indicated that he will consult before introducing a bill to do so. As we await the precise language of the proposed reforms, it will be mere shadow boxing or premature for me to preempt the process. The central concern of those calling for reform is that the words offend and insult in Section 18C place unlawfulness at too low a threshold. In order better to understand and respond to concerns about the reach of Section 18C, I'd like to discuss in these calmer days of a new government the history and aims of the racial abuse laws and to examine how they've actually worked in practice and before our courts. I particularly want to discuss the interplay between Section 18C and D of the Act, much less discussed. Section 18D protects freedom of speech and provides an exemption from what would otherwise be unlawful speech. Indeed, as we shall see, Section 18D is a rare legislative protection under Australian law for freedom of expression. I'd like to suggest to you that from a human rights perspective, Section 18C, qualified as it is by 18D, has proved for the last 18 years to be a legitimate, fair and effective protection against racial abuse in public. As we shall see, the Federal Court or Courts and the High Court of Australia have applied the law, in my view, in a balanced and reasonable way, so that any reform to this law should strive to maintain the balance, first by doing what lawyers do, identify the mischief to be prevented, and secondly, by drafting legislation which it gives effect to that identified mischief. At the Australian Human Rights Commission, we do have a special reason to know how important the prohibition of racial hatred is under current law to the Australian community, because we receive about 17,000 inquiries and conciliate over 2,000 complaints a year in respect of our legislative mandates that cover race, age, sex, children, disability, and some wider human rights. Of immediate relevance to the societal value of Section 18C is a 59% increase in complaints that we received in the last year concerning racial abuse, most of which arose over the internet or social media. The recent anti-Semitic attack in Sydney, while rare, also demonstrates the need for laws that protect against racial hatred and violence. In striking contrast, we receive perhaps a handful of complaints a year alleging a breach to the right to freedom of speech. It's clear to us, at least from our complaints process, that Australians are much more concerned about their freedom from racial abuse in public places than they are about the limitations on their freedom to speak. In short, and with great respect to Voltaire, Australia should not defend to the death those who abuse their right to freedom of speech by vilifying others in public on the ground of race. The fundamental protections provided by Sections 18C and D should be retained in any reform initiative. But what is freedom of speech? Let's begin by looking at the nature of that right. And the origins, as you will know, lie in the work of the father of liberalism, John Locke. He influenced the adoption of the idea of freedom of speech as a central component of democracy. And that was picked up by the United States in the First Amendment to the Constitution. It was the first time a constitution was to pick up this issue. It's commonly understood as a necessary and an enabling phenomenon for democratic governance. The principle of free speech as a vital pillar of democracy was then adopted in national constitutions and legislation, and importantly in the common law and civil law courts, to give flesh to the idea on a case-by-case method. The international community then articulated the idea in the 1948 United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and ultimately, in more precise terms, in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights in 1966. And in very simple terms, that Article 19 of the International Covenant provides that everyone should have the right to freedom of expression, but it recognises that the right is not and has never been an absolute right. It may be subject to various restrictions that are necessary for the respect of the rights or reputations of others, for the protection of national security, of public order, and of public health or morals. And Benjamin Franklin understood as early as 1722 the need to balance the right with other freedoms, and he wrote, "Without freedom of speech, which is the right of every man, as far as by it he does not hurt or control the right of another." Well, in practice, there are many limitations on the right to freedom of speech in most legal systems in respect of consumer protection laws, defamation, copyright, contempt of court and parliament, censorship, blasphemy, child pornography, incitement to genocide or incitement to discrimination, hostility or violence. But in particular, we've seen a very strong development in the international environment being the obligation to bring in legislation against the advocacy of national, racial or religious hatred that constitutes an incitement to discrimination, hostility or violence. And that has been given even greater precision by the Racial Discrimination Convention that condemns the promotion of racial hatred and requires states to make it unlawful to disseminate ideas based on racial superiority or hatred. Now, international law gives states a very wide discretion as to how they actually carry out these obligations to which, of course, Australia has become a party. So how have these obligations been actually met by Australia? Well, Australia has been historically a good international citizen. Led after the Second World War by the brilliant, if rather testy, Doc Evatt as president then of the United Nations General Assembly, Australia has been an active player in drafting the human rights treaties to which we almost invariably become a party. Australia's support for human rights renders it all the more curious that we've been very cautious and piecemeal in implementing these rights in our national laws. Australia is virtually unique among comparable legal systems in that it has no explicit constitutional protections for most human rights, the right to religion being a notable exception. Moreover, Australia has no Human Rights Act or Charter as such. The Parliament and Government, especially through the recently created Joint Parliamentary Scrutiny Committee on Human Rights, play the primary role in restricting or protecting our rights. We have, in other words, created a regime for the protection of human rights that's essentially a parliamentary and administrative one rather than a constitutional or legislative one. Now, as I said, international law isn't particularly fussed about how you get to the right answer, how you achieve protections for human rights. And this process of administrative parliamentary scrutiny is entirely acceptable so long as it's a means of achieving the right outcomes in protecting human rights. The right to freedom of expression is also protected by the common law and developed by the Australian courts. The High Court has said that everybody is free to do anything subject to the provisions of the law, so that one proceeds upon the assumption of freedom of speech and turns to the law to discover the established exceptions to it. The common law has its own set of constitutional rights, even if these are not formally entrenched against legislative repeal. Here, then, is the rub. While freedom of speech is protected by what's described particularly by our current Chief Justice as a principle of legality, Parliament can always override that clear the freedom by clear and unambiguous words, and it does so. Another means of achieving human rights under Australian law is through the work of the Australian Human Rights Commission. And we, I'm very proud to be able to say, provide access to justice for thousands of Australians at no cost to either the complainant or the person complained against. But it's not widely understood that the key international treaties to which Australia has become a party, particularly the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, while it's a benchmark for our work at the Commission, is not part of Australian law because it hasn't been legislated through Parliament into our domestic law. The result is that the Court is not able to apply that key convention setting out these fundamental freedoms. For example, obviously, the right to freedom of speech, but other rights, the right not to be detained arbitrarily without charge or trial when our courts determine the cases before them. So, in short, the core human rights freedoms cannot be used as a sword with which to protect and enforce our rights in the courts. Despite this technical legal failure to implement international human rights in our national laws, Australians know that they have a right to freedom of speech, a right that's undeniably an entrenched part of our culture. However, Australians are very unlikely to know that we have few explicit protections for this freedom. The Constitution doesn't mention it, and there are very few laws that do. Rather, in the tradition of the common law, the High Court has implied a freedom of political communication as a necessary means of participating in a parliamentary system of representative and responsible government. Apart from that implied right to political communication, which is not, of course, a full freedom to speech, few legislative protections exist. So it's ironic in the context of the debate about the reform of Section 18C that Section 18D provides one of the few explicit protections of the right to freedom of speech under Australian law. Section 18D provides exemptions for words or behaviour that are unlawful racial abuse if what was said or done was reasonable and in good faith in respect of an artistic work, a genuine purpose in the public interest, or a publication of a fair and accurate report of public interest. Well, let's just look briefly, before we look at some of the cases, at what has been the history of Section 18C and why we introduced it in Australia after many years of discussion and debate. The sections were introduced in the Racial Hatred Bill of 1995 at the request of the Australian Institute of Jewish Affairs, the leaders of Italian, Greek, Vietnamese and Chinese communities, following a national inquiry into racial violence which was conducted by the predecessor to the Australian Human Rights Commission, the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, in 1991. Also, following the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody report, also in that year, and a report of the Law Reform Commission on Multiculturalism and Law the following year. The words offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate that have raised such public and political concern were drawn from the much earlier Sex Discrimination Act of 1984. And in the second reading speech for the bill, the Attorney General Michael Lavarch stated, "It needs to be recognised that racial hatred does not exist in a vacuum. It provides a climate in which people of a particular race or ethnic origin live in fear and in which discrimination can thrive. It provides the climate in which violence may take place. It is itself a threat to the well-being of the whole community, as well as to the individual or groups in the community. The bill strikes a balance between the right of free speech and other rights of Australians. It provides a safety net for racial harmony in Australia, sends a clear warning to those who might attack the principle of intolerance, and provides Australians who are the victims of racial hatred or violence with protection." So those were the underlying ideas that the then attorney put to support the bill, which was obviously passed and became part of the Racial Discrimination Act. Well, that's all very abstract, but the question that I'm particularly interested in is how has that law actually worked in practice? And there are some basic principles in the relatively few cases that have ever gone to the courts. And perhaps it might be understood that in terms of this legislation, matters cannot go to the court, federal courts, unless they come to the Human Rights Commission first. The point being that we attempt to conciliate, we investigate and conciliate matters first. We eliminate about a third, 35% of matters that come to us on the basis that they're vexatious or there's no legal basis for the claim. With the others, we attempt to conciliate them, and we do, in fact, conciliate about 65% of the formal claims. But my point is that those matters cannot come to the court until they've been through the process with us first. And relatively few each year go to the federal court, and I'm pleased to be able to say that in no instance has the federal court overturned a finding of the President of the Human Rights Commission. So what I'm suggesting by this is that it's a relatively successful means of access to justice for people with virtually no cost. But what's come out of these cases, and I'll give you some examples in a moment. Firstly, the courts have held that the section is constitutionally valid and that it doesn't impose a burden on the right to freedom of political communication because it's reasonably appropriate and adapted to serve a legitimate end. It's compatible with the maintenance of government under the Constitution. Secondly, the courts have found that the words that offend, insult, humiliate and intimidate must be of a serious nature. And Justice Kiefel, now of the High Court of Australia, said the section applied only to profound and serious effects, not to be likened to mere slights. Third, the test is objective, based on the reasonable victim test, assessed by reference to community standards, and the context is to be taken into account. Fourth, the words offend, insult, humiliate and intimidate are to be taken collectively and not individually. In other words, the courts don't divide them up and say what is an insult, what is offending, what is intimidating or insulting. They look at the whole language as a whole. And fifthly, the civil actions that have been successful arise only in what I think a reasonable person might say are the most egregious and extreme cases at the very high end of the spectrum. Now, that's a relevant point because, as I mentioned when I began, the core problem appears to be that there is a community concerned by some, and certainly at the political level, that the words insult and offend are at too low a spectrum. The practice of the courts has been to insist on the highest level, but I'd like to look at some examples. And most of the cases in which this issue has come up have, in fact, taken the freedom of expression as trumping the offence of offending and insulting under 18C. But I thought we just might look at a few of them so you get a flavour for how this has actually worked in practice. And one of these cases was Coleman in Power in 2004. And this was a case that concerned an allegation by, perhaps not unusually, a law and politics student that with various flyers he gave out around town, that the Queensland police were corrupt. And he was charged with various offences, but including 18C. And the question for the High Court, ultimately, was whether or not he was to be liable under this section or whether he was protected by the implied constitutional freedom of political communication. Well, the High Court quashed his conviction for using insulting words, and the then Chief Justice Gleeson, Murray Gleeson, observed that one person's freedom ends where another person's right begins. And he gave the example, and I think it's quite a poignant one, of a mother who takes her children to the park and supposes that they're exposed to threats, abuse and insults on the ground that they're immigrants to Australia. And he says, why should the family's right to the quiet enjoyment of a public space necessarily be regarded as subordinate to the abuser's right to free expression of what might be generously described as a political opinion? The answer necessarily involves striking a balance between competing interests. Well, here the High Court said that this law and politics student had the right to allege that the Queensland police were corrupt because that was part of his right of political communication. Now, you may, as you hear these stories and cases, you may actually disagree with the outcome. But nonetheless, this is an example of a core point that I want to make, that the courts have almost invariably balanced this in the favour of the right to freedom of speech. Another example is the book published by Pauline Hanson and David Ettridge in a case Walsh and Hanson. And in that book, they suggested that the Aboriginal community was given priority by government in relation to welfare and other matters. And the court there took the view that this was published reasonably and in good faith for a genuine purpose in the public interest, namely public debate about the fairness of the distribution of social welfare benefits in the community. So again, freedom of speech trumped the concerns that the community might have had. Another one that I think is an important case, Kelly Country, a stand-up comedian, played an Aboriginal character called King Billy Coke Bottle as a grotesque caricature of an Aboriginal. It was deeply offensive to Aboriginal people, but the court again found that in the context of a comedy performance, where the aim is deliberately to give offence and to make jokes at the expense of others in the community, the offence was in context, not out of proportion, and was reasonable. Another one, Brofo's case that you might recall in 2004. This was a case where the West Australian newspapers published a cartoon called Alas, Poor Yagan. And this was a case in which the head of an Aboriginal leader had been taken to England and buried in the graveyard in Liverpool. And as you well know, many Aboriginal people whose bones are in England are now slowly being returned from museums and various places to Australia and properly honoured within their communities. So this was a serious matter for Australian Indigenous groups. And in the cartoon, the head was in a cardboard box and there was a thought bubble, and he expressed the desire that he preferred to be returned to England to avoid the acrimony within the Aboriginal community over the expenses of the various people who'd gone to England to bring back the head. Now, the court upheld the views of the Australian Human Rights Commission that the cartoon violated 18C. It did offend, insult, even maybe humiliate and intimidate, but it was exonerated. And exonerated on the recommendation of the Human Rights Commission, that the work had been published in good faith as an artistic work and for a genuine purpose in the public interest. The court upheld the right to freedom of expression despite very clear evidence that the cartoon offended the members of the Indigenous community. So another major case by the High Court in which freedom of expression was upheld. And another that you may recall, Hagen and the Toowoomba Sports Ground Trust, the court found that the naming of the E.S. Nigger Brown Stand was not an offensive racist act within the meaning of 18C because the context was one in which the word was a fond nickname of a much-loved man and the aim was to honour him, not to vilify him. So the stand remained with that name, even though some of us may, on looking at it for the first time and knowing nothing about the background of this particular footballer, I assume he was a footballer, we might find it offensive. His family and the community were not offended. Well, let's have a look at some of the very few cases where 18C unlawfulness has been found by the court. And one was Campbell and Kirstenfeld, where a white woman was found to have breached 18C for calling her neighbour racist names, which I won't repeat, and telling her to go back to the scrub where you belong. The court found that was deliberate insult, offensive, and a breach, and it was in public, and it was based on race. There's a series of litigation that you may recall, Jones against Tobin. Dr. Tobin published a great deal of anti-Semitic material on the World Wide Web, denying the Holocaust, among other things. I think also saying that those of the Jewish race who refused to accept his views were of lower intelligence than others. So it was a deeply insulting contribution to a particular website, which was then becomes a meme and is copied and taken out. Well, here the courts took the view that his acts were in the public arena, they were there on racial grounds, and they were deliberately insulting and fell within the prohibition in 18C and not protected by the right to freedom of speech. We found that a very important case because, for the reason I mentioned a moment ago, and that is that because so much racial abuse now is occurring in social media and the internet, we needed the jurisprudence, if you like, to know that the courts are prepared to find that this is and can be a breach of 18C. But now we come to the cause célèbre. Stimulating calls for reform is the much-discussed and misunderstood Etok and Bolt in 2011. The federal court found that Mr. Bolt had breached 18C in reporting that prominent fair-skinned Aboriginal people of mixed heritage had falsely identified as Aboriginal to claim various benefits available only to Aboriginal people. The court reached two vital conclusions. First, that Mr. Bolt had written a report that was reasonably likely to offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate a person in public on the basis of his race, etc., contrary to Section 18C. But secondly, the court applied Section 18D that ensures artistic work, scientific debate and fair comment are exempt from prosecution. And the court found that Mr. Bolt could not claim the benefit of free speech here because he had not acted reasonably or in good faith and because his report was neither fair nor accurate on the facts. In short, Mr. Bolt's right to freedom of speech was restricted because his journalism was an abuse of that right. And the federal court judge was careful to make clear that his findings were not that it's unlawful to challenge the sincerity of Aboriginal self-identification to be available for particular benefits. Rather, the judge found a contravention of 18C had occurred because of the manner in which the subject matter had been dealt with and the failure to meet the freedom of speech provisions in 18D. Now, the last one I very quickly want to mention, and you may remember this one, was decided earlier this year by the High Court of Australia in Monis against the Queen. And this would consider not 18C, but a very similar piece of legislation, which was the which prohibited the use of the Commonwealth Postal Services in a way that a reasonable person would regard as menacing, harassing, or offensive. The two accused had sent letters to the families of Australian soldiers killed in Afghanistan, and the court found that those letters, as a matter of judgment of the court, were denigratory and derogatory. The Court of Criminal Appeal convicted the accused because the letters were at least offensive, certainly also probably menacing and harassing. And the Court of Criminal Appeal, and the Chief Justice in particular, stressed that the words offensive require a strong reaction of anger, rage, distrust, or hatred, which I think was demonstrated on the facts. But those prosecuted successfully appealed to the High Court, and legal counsel argued eloquently that the letters were merely a political opposition to the war in Afghanistan, and they should be protected by the right to freedom of speech. So it raises a very difficult question. This was done in a way that offended the people most likely to be deeply hurt. But at the same time, the points raised in the letters were designed to make a wider political point that Australia ought not to be engaged in that war. Now, which do we try to protect, or how do we protect that those rights in that extremely difficult situation? Well, if it can happen, it will happen. One of the judges was not able to sit on this court, and so the court was split 3-3. And for the lawyers here, you'll know that if the High Court split 3-3, the lower court conviction stands. But I want to raise in particular the views of the three women on the High Court who, in a very clear, very simple joint judgment, said that in their view, the right to freedom of speech, and right in terms of implied constitutional freedom of political communication, was not unreasonably burdened by this prohibition on offensive use of the Commonwealth Postal Services. So to put that in plainer English, ultimately the convictions could stand because the prohibition on the use of the Postal Service for this purpose was acceptable and was not an unreasonable burden on the right to freedom of speech so far as it's interpreted by the court. Now, what is interesting, though, for the future, and why that is why we never categorically know the answer to legal questions, is that the three other male members of the court, including our Chief Justice, took the view that, in fact, the postal law did impermissibly burden the right to political communication, and had they been able to carry the day, they would have overturned the convictions. So the convictions remained because the Court of Criminal Appeal at the lower level had made that determination, and a 3-3 decision couldn't overturn it. So nothing's certain. So what do these cases tell us about 18C and the similar laws that have been applied? Well, the Australian courts have endorsed the importance of freedom of speech as a right that is integral to our multicultural society. Freedom has been qualified in very narrow circumstances by requiring that it be exercised reasonably. Actions under 18C have succeeded only where the offending words are deeply offensive on an objective test of the reasonable person in all the circumstances. And in doing so, the courts have readily understood that freedom of expression can work to undermine the commitment to democracy where it's employed to propagate ideas that are contrary to democratic values. Hate propaganda, say the courts, works in just such a way, arguing as it does for a society in which the democratic process is subverted and individuals are denied respect and dignity simply because of racial or sometimes religious characteristics. Where the court has found the words or acts to be unlawful, a strong message, both real and symbolic, has been made that racial vilification will not be tolerated and that the undoubted right to speak freely may not be abused. The freedoms of countless racial and ethnic communities in Australia to enjoy public spaces will be protected at the cost of restricting the right of a few to speak. To test whether we have the balance right, though, we might briefly look at the society we'd have if we were to reverse the court's findings. If there were no Section 18C, Bolt would have been able to make with impunity what the court found to be inaccurate statements in bad faith, regardless of their effect on Aboriginal people. The Holocaust could be denied regularly, and abusive letters to the families of our war dead could be freely posted. I suggest this is not a vision of Australia that we want to promote, and it's one that would be positively harmful to our very successful multicultural society. So in conclusion, it is of course legitimate for a newly elected government to consider for itself whether the correct balance has been struck between different human rights, especially when the then opposition raised and repeated its concerns about Section 18C in speeches and debates before the election. In the absence of a precise draft proposal in a reform bill, however, it's premature for me to discuss the options in any detail. Suggestions for reform range from abolition of the sections entirely to merely deleting the words offending and insulting. But we don't yet know what it is that the government is proposing, and we of course await the consultative process that the attorney is undertaking. Whatever reform the government decides to adopt, the Australian Human Rights Commission welcomes the public debate, and we encourage the attorney to consult with leaders of the community, especially those most vulnerable to racial abuse. The right to freedom of speech is a fragile flower. It depends on protection by Parliament, the courts, the Commission, and most importantly, by the Australian community. The Commission has long argued for Commonwealth legislation to protect our fundamental freedoms, including the right to free speech. But in the meantime, I believe that a balance can be achieved of the common law right to freedom of expression with the right to enjoy public spaces free of racial abuse. Most Australians understand the need for a balance of freedoms and accept that this balance may need to be recalibrated over time to reflect community values. Race hatred laws have been one of the foundations of our enviable multicultural society. If the government decides to reform sections 18 C and D, it should do so with care and on the basis of objective evidence, what is the mischief to be prevented, and mindful of the high symbolic value of the race laws that underpin our vibrant and free democracy. Thank you very much.
Professor Triggs, many thanks. And so we come to question and discussion. First of all, once again, thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this fine facility this evening. So we've got till the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. Just leading off, I haven't read the ETOC, the Bolt case, for about a year, but as I recall, in the federal court, the judge expressed concern about Mr. Bolt's tone. In other words, he wasn't commenting so much on what Andrew Bolt said, but the way in which he said it. So in other words, not the words themselves, but the kind of tone of the discussion. That seemed to be, I know the case was not appealed, but that seemed to be a kind of contentious area where the objection was not to what he said, but to how he said it. Mm. If you come back to where you were here.
Yes, I think the word I believe that the Justice Brumberg used was the manner in which he had gone about it. And I have certainly taken that to mean that if you get your research wrong, where the fundamental facts about the people he was attacking were wrong in terms of their heritage, their connection with Australia, etc., then the protection that you would normally get as a journalist is lost. And that was the key point that Brumberg was making. Now, I know that there has been discussion afterwards about a variety of facts that were right or wrong. And as you say, that what would normally happen in this sort of instance would be that you appeal. And matters of this kind are not usually left with one judge of the federal court. And it may be that those facts will be differently viewed by an appellate court. But it's very unusual for an appellate court to overturn on the basis of facts. So I think the key point that the judge wanted to make was that there was inaccuracy and it was not fair comment in light of that inaccuracy and in light of what he believed was ultimately not good faith.
There's a question down the back and then up here. Yeah.
Professor Tripp, Australia does not have a Bill of Rights, nor has there ever been a strong community movement for a Bill of Rights. Does that not reflect the phlegmatic and non-prescriptive nature of Australian society?
Thank you. Does that not reflect the non-prescriptive nature of Australian society, and does it not reflect the lack of serious concern that you're expressing about, or have expressed tonight, about issues relating to 18C?
Well, as you recall, we've had a major public listening tour and consideration as to whether or not we should have a Charter of Rights, and that really is a proposal that does not have community support. And I think you're right in saying that Australians have not seen the need for this legislative introduction of a charter like New Zealand, like Canada, like the United Kingdom, reflecting the whole of Europe, North America, and most other civil law countries. We've not seen the need for it. Now, why we've not seen the need is an important sort of socio-political question. And one answer to that, and perhaps implied by your question, is that we actually think that we've got human rights broadly right in Australia. And I think, in fairness, we probably have. We've been a leader, as I said earlier, in creating... Australia always punches a bit above its weight in these diplomatic negotiating sessions, from Doc Evatt, as I mentioned, all the way through to the Rome Statute for International Criminal Court. We play a very strong role. But when we bring them home, when we bring these treaties back home, we're not so happy to give them effect. And one has to ask, you know, why is this? I think there is a belief in Australia that we can reach the right answers through the political processes, through Parliament, and through scrutiny processes, and through administrative processes, which are the kind of thing that we do at the Human Rights Commission. There's also in Australia, and this is venturing an opinion, so take it for what it's worth, there seems to be a curious distrust in Australia of the judiciary giving jurisprudential flesh to the meaning of the words. If you draft these rights, like there is a right to freedom of expression, that's what you draft. Only the courts can interpret what that actually means, or in the first instance, bodies like the Human Rights Commission, because we do that daily. And I say, we seem to get it right most of the time. But there does seem to be an interesting phenomenon in Australia that we resist this. But it's curious, though, because the core freedoms that we all believe in Australia, in the main, were created by judges through the common law system. That's where they came from. So we're reluctant to accept that, but it is a reality. So I think you're right in raising the fact that we do have difficulty with this. But there are areas where clearly we're in egregious breach of international law. One is, of course, our obligations to our First Nations peoples, to Australian Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders, the factual evidence of the a failure to ensure that they have rights is there for all to see. I, of course, have been deeply concerned about the failure to meet international standards in relation to asylum seekers and the treatment and conditions in which asylum seekers, particularly children. We have something like 6,500 people in closed prisons, so-called detention centres, and about, at the moment, 1,050 of those are children. And this is in breach of the simplest rules of basic human rights law. And yet we have, because we don't have protections in our constitution or in our legislation, it's impossible for the courts to give effect to the standards that almost every comparable legal system would have a capacity to do.
There's a question here. Yeah.
I don't think I need the mic.
Just take a minute.
Thank you for that speech. As a non-lawyer, I'm curious as to what extent these issues arise because the focus is on the rights and not on the responsibilities that are implicit in those rights. So if your commission was called the Human Rights and Responsibilities Commission, to what extent would these issues change So, for example, in the cases that you mentioned, I didn't see an approach whereby I would say, look, you can make the political point that you're making, but can it be made in a way which is not offensive, mm-hmm. which is not vilification, which is not, you know, aggressive?
Yeah.
Can that live in the law?
Well, it does, but I think probably you're right in putting a view that a lot of Australians have, and that is that we don't use the language of responsibility very often. It's actually there, buried in the language. And if we go back to the Bolt case, the point the court was making, and they made it very, very clearly, is that it was concerned about the failure to exercise the right to freedom of speech in a responsible and proper way. And you might be aware that within two or three weeks of this case, SBS ran a program on exactly the same issue. But they did it in a balanced way. They got the public involved. They raised the issues. It was somewhat heated on occasions and rather difficult to watch in some respects. But there, they explored the question of identification as an Aboriginal person. And they did it in a way that brought all the issues out. And they did it in a responsible way. So I think one of the things I take from your question is the need to, if we're talking about reform of this law, maybe we can pick up some of the language of responsible exercise. And that's really what we're saying when we talk about abuse of the right to freedom of speech. You're putting it more positively and probably more helpfully. Have you exercised that right in a responsible way in the multicultural environment in which we live?
But on the SBS show, as I recall, it was Indigenous Australians calling other Indigenous Australians not Indigenous or not really Indigenous. That was what was different.
True.
Thank you very much, Professor Treats. The change in nomenclature of refugees to illegals, is this vilification?
Well, I certainly think that it's designed to demean them and to imply to all ordinary Australians that they are in breach of the law, that they've committed an offence. I'm not going to go... It's not an 18C issue, I can promise you, but nonetheless, I take your point. My position would be, If they're illegal, let us charge them and prosecute and have a trial. Instead of which, we have people in effectively jails for years where their claims to asylum status are not being assessed. We've got 33,000 people in Australia at the moment who've been waiting months and sometimes years to have their claims assessed. But that is rather off our topic today. Thank you.
We want to keep on the topic if we can. John Highfield and then down the back. Yeah.
Yes, you mentioned, of course, that there's no inclination in the body of Australians to go for a Bill of Rights. But in regard to the children, particularly who have been held in the detention centres, there is a substantial body of evidence which shows that those children in previous detention situations have been emotionally murdered during their being locked up, and that many of those children subsequently released into the Australian community are still suffering substantial mental health condition. Australia would appear to be in breach of international conventions like the Convention on the Rights of Children and so on, and yet we go on emotionally murdering these children in Nauru and Manus, and yet there is no inclination in our governing bodies on either side of politics to do something about what is self-evidently a grievous infringement of these children's rights?
That, again, is not really what I came here to talk about today, I have to say, but the evidence is now growing about the effect of detention on children, even community detention, but most particularly in the closed detention centres that we have. And these children are being harmed, and they will live, and we in Australia will live with that heritage, because the probable result is that almost all of these people will remain part of the Australian community for a very long time, probably forever. Now, there will be some exceptions to that, but this is the reality, and I think that I would like to see leadership that takes up these questions, because I think that we're a much better country than this suggests, and I think there's a growing sense in the community that we can grapple with this and deal with it in a more sensible way, in a more humane way that meets the very evidence that you've just been describing.
We've got to move on. Question down the back.
Just going back to the Bolt decision, what was your view on the publisher's liability in that decision?
Well, it's based on the principle of vicarious liability. In other words, they're either directly liable for publishing it, or they're vicariously liable for the act of Bolt in making the report. So they have to act, if I can take up the gentleman's point, they have to act responsibly as publishers. And no publisher can you can't defame somebody, you can't blaspheme, you can't do all sorts of things in publications. You've got to publish the truth in advertising, etc. There are lots and lots of restrictions on the way in which the press, the media, is allowed to produce its product. This is really an example of where a newspaper publisher will be liable for an act which breaches this provision. I should stress that this is a civil law provision. It's unlawful, and it could bring a compensation payment or requirement for an apology, but it's not a criminal offence.
There's a question here.
Yeah. Professor, I appreciate your very lucid delineation between freedom of speech and racial vilification. What I seem to have missed is any reference to what penalties apply for a breach of either of these statutes.
As I was just mentioning to the previous questioner, this is a civil unlawfulness. It's not a criminal offence. So what will happen here is that, firstly, the court can order an apology, which very often complainants want. It's many times not about the money, and we find this in the Commission quite frequently. It's not about the money. What they want is a recognition that this racial abuse in the canteen, in a workplace, on the tram, I'm talking Melbourne now, on the train or on the bus in Sydney, what they want is the apology and the recognition that that behaviour is not acceptable. However, the courts also have a power to make a compensatory award. It's usually quite small, $5,000, $10,000, and we also recommend payments of small monetary amounts. But that's it. It's basically about getting the symbolic message out to the community that you should not do this in a public place, and requiring an apology where it's appropriate, or some form of compensatory damages. And we can often negotiate something with the bigger groups. For example, in a sexual harassment case, a well-known one, the damage, the compensation there was really very substantial, but that's unusual. It's usually very small.
It's a question here. We've got to be quick now. Yes.
Yes, when I was a child, lots of people said they didn't want any Catholics or Irish coming to Australia. As a Catholic and pan-Irish, I didn't like that. But that was what you said, and I didn't mind, and you had an answer. You said something about the Protestants. But it seems to me nowadays, since the Bolt case, a lot of quite ordinary people really want to say we don't want any Muslims coming to Australia, but they don't know whether they're allowed to say that anymore, or whether, you know, they're liable to have something, if they said it in public or actually put it in writing, whether they'd have some legal action taken against them.
Well, again, I think that it's a pity that that's having a chilling effect. But in a free society, and as I say, most of these cases come down on the side of freedom of speech, as you've seen from the cases I've been through. Almost all of them. So where somebody has been responsible, to go back to that word again, where they've exercised their right in a reasonable way, in good faith. So if you want to put the argument that modern Australia should not allow more Italians, pommy migrants like me, Greeks, Armenians, Muslims, if that's your view, of course you're entitled to put that view. But you put it in a way which is hopefully factually accurate and in good faith. And so long as you do that, then your right to make the comment is protected by the law. But when you do it in bad faith, you get your facts wrong and you do it driven by racial hatred, then that's not acceptable, and that's the way the balance works in practice. But I think that your point is one that I think a lot of people make. that the public's now frightened of everything they're going to say. That's not what it's intended to do, and we probably need to be better informed about how it actually works. And I think more accurate information about what happened in the Bob case or in the Tobin case and in all of the others I mentioned, if we knew those a little bit better. And I realise it's a lawyer talking here, so it's hard to get that message across. But nonetheless, I think if we understood this better, we'd understand that from your perspective, if you want to say something about not so many Protestants coming to Australia, you're absolutely free to say it, but you must say it in good faith because you're really concerned about it.
Question, yeah.
Is there anything explicit or implicit in what's gone on so far which recognises what you can call a retaliatory or a provocative precedent communication?
Is there a retaliatory, provocative, precedent association?
I think what you're talking about, if I can interpret what you're saying, what you're saying is if somebody's made a racist remark in public, on a bus, for example, would they be excused if somebody made an extremely insulting statement to them on the bus and it was a reaction to it? Well, the courts always look at the whole context. And if you've been abused yourself, then it's not at all unusual to abuse the person back and maybe do so on racial grounds. I have no hesitation in saying that courts will always take that into account. It will be highly unlikely that the retaliatory remark will be seen as an offence in itself in those circumstances.
Just as a final question, you're making the point that, and I think it's a very valid point, that you essentially look at apologies or corrections, you look at low monetary payments if there are made. But there is another side of the Commission, as far as I'm aware, that came up earlier this year, where the Commission went into active social media role, and the Disability Commissioner started urging Australians to boycott a major retail store. And I think you distance yourself from that. It does seem to be a bit over the top, because the person who had made the statement had made a reasonable economic statement about how he interpreted the effect of a tax as against the effect of a government payment on the retail industry. It seemed a valid kind of comment. Whether it was true or not was another point. Accurate or not is another point. So to what extent is the Commission going to get into a much more active role in getting people up on social media, up on the web, campaigning for views that part of the Commission maintained should be implemented by government?
Well, look, Gerard, that's a fair question, and I deserve it. But let me try to answer it in two ways. Firstly, the Commission does not target businesses. We do not target individual businesses. And we have protocols that determine how we go about our work. We are a government agency, a statutory protected body, and it is not part of our process to become a sort of social activist. That is not our job. Our job is to monitor human rights compliance by Australia and to advocate where appropriate. Now, as you know, and it's been in the papers, Commissioner Innes did take action which was outside the processes of the Commission. Now, let me explain why, in fairness to Commissioner Innes. And you'll all remember that those in the disability field, carers and those that are disabled, have been watching this political debate for the creation of a national disability insurance scheme for a very, very long time, and those in the area have been calling for it for decades. Now they were within a hair's breadth of achieving it. The government had made an announcement, and it had been on a bilateral political basis. So both parties supported it, which in the election year was an extraordinary phenomenon. They nearly got there. When you have the levy being discussed by the chief executive of the major retailing company, Myer. Now, from the perspective of that group that supports disability rights, and Graham as a representative of those rights, these comments that the monies were better spent in the cash registers for Myers was a, to go back to the language of today's talk, deeply offensive and very worrying, because they thought that this would destabilise the political commitment to getting a disability scheme up. That's the environment in which this took place. Now, it was not an appropriate action from the point of view of the Commission, but it was an action that was at least understandable from a human point of view and from the point of view of those in the disability sector. Now, the Commission does not behave in this way, and we will not be behaving in this way in the future. We've certainly seen the damage that can be done to all parties in something as public as this, and certainly my view as president and my position as president is that we are not social activists and we do not engage in attacking businesses in this way. So we hope to work, and I can finish on a positive note, we hope as a priority for the Commission over the next two or three years that we will be working particularly with small to medium businesses to see if we can work in a holistic way with them to look at employing disabled people more than they do, not insisting on quotas or having petitions or anything of that kind. We're not going to go near that, but we'd like to work with them to get systemic change in a way that's positive, and we want to do it in relation to women and employment, race issues, Indigenous issues, children, with our new Children's Commissioner, and in relation to age with Susan Ryan, who's doing such an outstanding job putting the point about employment and productive employment of our aged Australians. So that's what we're doing under my presidency, and that is, I hope, an episode that we can put behind us.
Many thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Some of you would have been present. We had earlier in the year, we had Senator George Brandeis talking on some of these matters that Professor Triggs has addressed tonight. When he was opposition shadow, we had Mark Dreyfus when he was the Attorney General. Now those roles are reversed. And it was great tonight to hear from Professor Gillian Triggs on the general issue. It's been a very frank talk. It's been an interesting talk, an informative talk. There's a lot of information in the paper. We'll be very pleased to publish it. It's good that television's here tonight and it'll be up on our podcast tomorrow. So we've had a very frank exchange of views, which has been pleasing and informative. I've learned a lot, and I'm very grateful that Professor Triggs could come here. I'm glad she's joined up to the Sydney Institute. We'll see her around a lot more in the future. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.